Texas, studying a form of acupressure for the chakras. And one day it was raining, and I don't remember how it happened, but I went to a bookstore, a little spiritual bookstore, way far away. I don't know how I got there. And I got 3 books. And I'm talking about them today. And I read them, I think, probably mostly. The one I can't find and forgot the name of anymore, I read all the way. About becoming parts of nature. The wind, the water. And the other two were about Findhorn and Paralandra. And the Paralandra book has been facing me on my bedside bookshelf for at least 8 years. Never touched it. Knew about it. Knew what it was, basically. In March, I started reading. And I had to read and read and read, and I started ordering books, and I started creating a lending library. And I have been on fire with this message. And I'm not even all the way through this one again for this time, but it's filled with writing and notes. And so is this one, and so is this one. And this one we're really working on a lot. Now, what this story is that, first of all, I'm sure many of you have heard of or know a lot about Findhorn. Show me if you have. Okay. And have you heard also about Paralandra? Okay, smaller group. I think of that as the next step. I think of that as chapter 2 of the story from nature. So quite a few hands went up on Findhorn. I'm going to be a little bit brief here, but I'm going to just recount very briefly here. Findhorn is a project on the north coast of Scotland in a very sandy, windy place that was a tiny little resort town. In the summers, and there are 3 adults whose story has gone into deeply, being prepared for listening to God and a letting God be above all else, including the married couple, each other. And they were tried and tested, and this has gone into in this book. And they all 3 lost their jobs. It's a husband and wife who have 3 boys, youngish. They're given very little attention in the writings, but I think they're like 10 and under. And also a dear long-term woman friend of theirs. And the 2 women had been taught, guided, inspired to write, listening to God, listening for messages for years. And the man had been through this Peter Caddy, Eileen Caddy's wife, and Dorothy McLean, their dear friend. And Peter had been put through strenuous spiritual training, starting as a boy and ending up as an adult in the Air Force of the British Army in World War II, and had to trek across the Himalayas in winter, and actually had to do a 30-mile trek to find somebody that got lost when even the Sherpa couldn't do it. So extraordinary people, and they lost their jobs all at once. They were working for a hotel, making it a great success, and they were all given notice and given no reason why, and they ended up going on welfare, Scottish welfare. And they had a trailer, a little live-in trailer that was at this little resort community, which was very near the hotel, where they had been working for quite a few years. And so that's the only thing they had. So they went there, and it's November, October, November. It's ridiculous there. It's nothing but wind and sand, and everybody's gone. And they made it through. And in the spring, Peter started to make a garden real quick so they'd have food. And pretty soon Dorothy, who's meditating has been guided to start listening to nature, looking, why don't you start practicing with nature, they said. And so she's decided that she really liked green peas. And so she would try to talk to them. She immediately got a very intelligent and astute lecture on how human beings treat the nature kingdom and how it's a little bit hard for them to trust us. And she's surprised that she's asking to talk to it. However, she held her position, and Dorothy did, and pretty soon they were getting a lot of information on how to grow in this soil, in this non-soil, and having nice synchronicities happen with getting straw and manure and building up bits of soil. And pretty soon they were growing vegetables like cabbages waist high. Now this was big work for nature to have to work this hard and help them so much, but they wanted to make a point, and people did come from all over the world and document this. And they were hesitant to talk about, Peter was hesitant especially, Peter would be sort of the front man, and he was hesitant to talk about the role of spirit, the role of the devas, the role of God in what they were doing. But eventually that came out. And pretty soon nature didn't have to make such big vegetables because people got the message. And the message was very simple. If nature and humans will co-create, we can do more than a part. We can do a whole new third level. Because nature's been holding its own with us, and it hasn't completely abandoned the earth. And it's important to note that there have been many indigenous models of living all throughout time, and there are many people in this room and that we know and all over the world with green thumbs, and there are all kinds of ways we're communing with nature. So we want to, I want that to be on the table as I speak about this. What I'm feeling for me is a new level of understanding. And really, ultimately, Findhorn drew many people from around the world, spiritual seekers, and people who came there to live and partake in this community. And ultimately, my takeaway is that a lot of what the message of Findhorn was Christ consciousness, to live in alignment, to live in community with that level of joy and love. Right on, Jerry. He said it a million times for us. And simultaneously, on the East Coast, Mikkel Small Wright, Mikkel Small, who married Clarence Wright, that's how I remember it, was having a tumultuous life also being trained, also being brought through enormous tumult in order to turn to the inner life. And hers was, is the first half of this book. You can kind of go to page 100 and start there. But it's fascinating to hear how creative, industrious, patient, strong, intuitive, she became, having been abandoned by her parents. And in her early 20s, late teens, she starts to be recognized through synchronicities, that she realizes that she has a lot of inner connection with her intuition and with ways of knowing. And she checks out a lot of mainstream Christianity, and she kind of drifts away from that. She's sort of seeking. And ultimately, in her early 20s, she and Clarence get married, and they move outside of Washington, D.C. to 10 acres. Clarence goes into town every day, into the city to work. and she's there. And she realizes that there's a buzz. Now I'm in the territory where most of you haven't heard about it, right? She starts to hear a buzz, feel a buzz, coming from the woods. And she doesn't understand it, of course, at first. And finally she realizes, well, she'll say hello. She realizes she's not afraid. It's not frightening her. And right away, she gets an answer back, and she gets about 100 voices back. And she remembers that somewhere she had experienced or read somebody saying, hey, wait a minute, one voice at a time. So she says that, and right away, one voice at a time, clear as a bell. And they say, we've been waiting for you. We want to work with you. We want to talk with you. And so she starts getting schooled by nature, what she knows as nature. And she realizes that there's a workshop going on at Findhorn in Scotland, and she knows she needs to go. And by this time, she's been working with nature enough on her land that they've been teaching her literally sequences of activities, protocols, very clear, succinct directions of how to contact them, what their role is, and what our role is as the humans. So it boils down to she's working her way to clear up the garden for this, for the end of the season, and she knows Findhorn's calling, and she's at the point where she realizes that our job as the humans is clarity and direction. What we choose, we are, and we've learned this in various ways through all of our studies in this room, we are co-creators with the divine, is how we think of it. And nature's saying, well, the divine acts through us, partly. I made that part up, but that's what it seems like to me. And so by the time she gets to Findhorn, they're asking her so many questions, she almost does all the talking. Because she's been taken to a new place than was time at Findhorn. Findhorn was Christ consciousness, was love, was community, was the partnership with nature and what could happen, what was possible. And her work is the next level, which is how can we as humans work respectfully, equally with this whole other, I'm going to make this word up too, a whole other civilization, a whole other culture that's living all around us, everywhere, the pews, the rug, and certainly what we think of as life, the stones, the wood, obviously the plants. And the deal is that at least in the modern world, we've done nothing but abuse and take, as in general, not as individuals, but in general. And so the call was coming first at Findhorn and then at Perelandra to work directly together. And so I'm going to go back now for a minute to Findhorn, and I'm going to read my favorite short passage. It's 2:18, and it's the first time that Pan appears. And how many of you have a picture in your mind of Pan? Okay. He's wearing that shape, that presence, like the fairies and gnomes and other elementals. They wear thought forms, is what they're teaching us here. They're really light. They're really moving energies of light. However, they can use thought forms, and I suppose, I'm not clear, sort of co-create thought forms, because it makes it easier for them to do some of their work, all the elementals that are working with holding energy to create atoms and molecules and things and plants and water and so on. But the role of Pan, he's going to introduce himself to us briefly, and I'll speak about that a little bit. This is taking place on an island off the coast of Scotland, which is a very sacred island. A great monk in history had been gone there for meditation and so on. There's a circle of stones still there, and Peter Caddy is there, and this man nicknamed Rock, R. Ogilvy Crombie, who was very much a nature speaker, he came to realize, and worked and helped at Findhorn. And they're there, and they have gone to this island to see things. And he says, Rock says, we call him by his acronym, I became aware of a large figure lying in the ground. I could see him through the grass. It appeared to be a monk in a brown habit with the hood pulled over the head so that the features were concealed. His feet were toward the circle. As I watched, he raised his hands and rolled back the hood. It was Pan. He rose up out of the ground and stood facing us, an immense figure. In this book, they don't say how big. In this book, he says 25 feet tall, at least. That's really big. He stood facing us, an immense figure. He smiled and said, quote, I am the servant of Almighty God. I love that part. Helps put everything into place for me, of course. I am the servant of Almighty God, and I and my subjects are willing to come to the aid of mankind in spite of the way he has treated us. I think we could say in spite of the way they have treated us and abused nature, if he affirms he believes in us. He affirms his belief in us and asks for our help. Now, we're doing that in various ways. All of us. We're praying. We're letting how the prayer gets done get handled by the unseen world. Many of you will have various in-depth knowledge of how that feels and looks to you. As I say, all these other cultures and ways on the planet have done various things. But Pan refers to the nature kingdom as his subjects. Kind of a tricky one for me, but I've accepted it wholeheartedly. They can say anything they want. They're my equals. And so at one point, Rock, Ogilvy, he's the one who Pan makes contact with first and sort of remains that go-between throughout his life. He meets Pan in his late 60s, and he passes in his early 70s, so his work was done. He'd spent his lifetime studying the esoteric and the land and da-da-da-da. And In Pan's work with Rock during the time of his involvement in Findhorn, because he's from Edinburgh, he's from Scotland too, we we have the coupled encounters that he tells about where Pan walks into him, merges. Common enough to the esoteric world. And he is able to see suddenly what Pan sees, hears, feels, and it's immediately the woods, the world around him is filled with movement and every kind of elemental we could think of. Fairies, fauns, druids, I mean not druids, naiads, they say, sylphs. They're all busy moving, holding, and creating things. And they're joyous. They're dancing. They dance and sing and love their work. What's occurred is that they have vastly withdrawn from much of the world because of the abuse, and they have been heartbroken. They have been in despair. And there's an amazing encounter in both these books. Actually, all three of these are very helpful on Findhorn because you can cross-reference. They tell some of the same stories, but different ways. I love that part. And Pan has showed him that they have withdrawn, and we have one incredible scene where there's really a showdown, where it's sort of a place humans are blocked from coming in Scotland, and Rock enters it with Peter, and a number of times Rock has to be a communicator for the human race and apologize and say how much we ask for another chance and how much we didn't know what we were doing, and that he apologizes and he sees the wrong. But he hears them. And so the record went down on that. And my vision and my dream, first, when I started putting all this together, I thought, oh my gosh, we have to get the word out to the whole world, because this will help us, of course, with global warming. Because if we have the intention, we clear the oceans. Nature has the means. This is an astonishing reality. They can work with matter. That's their role, and they have to take direction from us, because that's our job. So then I heard an interview with Michael Pollan, and I thought, oh my God, he's the one. He can write a book. I still think that's a good idea. And he'll do all the research just like he's doing with psychedelics right now. It'll be awesome, and he's respected, and he's also put himself as an edgy writer. So I think he'll be a good one. Anybody's got any links there, let me know. But you know, I think that can happen. But then I realized, oh my gosh, this is it for each of us. So I've been talking to Pan. I just say, Pan, I'm speaking to you. I love you. Thank you. I want to help the plastics in the ocean. Let's get the plastics out of the ocean. Because we know it seems to be deeply beyond our capacities with them breaking down the photosynthesis. So the message that I'm carrying today is that I'm totally on a learning curve, and I have some of these books to lend. I didn't bring them today. I actually have to leave pretty soon in through the lunch. This is the girl, my age group, I'm guessing 70s, okay? This is the girl who's gonna tell us how to do everything, you guys. This is my primary healthcare model now. And this is the website of Paralandra has year after year of testimonial letters that people have written to her about the ways they're working with nature, using her protocols, that they're changing the world. I'll tell you one quick, time is short, but I'm gonna give you two stories. They're awesome. One's on moles. And she's new to the work, at her land, which is now 45 acres, but it was 10 acres then in the beginning, it was 10 acres. And she realizes that the moles are digging up the whole front yard, and there's a woods right next to it. And wouldn't it be nice if they moved over there? They'd have lots of room. So one morning, because she does a check-in with nature every morning, to sort of plan the day on the land, and she says, okay, moles, you're really being a problem in the yard, and I would like you to move over to the woods. And could you please do that tonight at 9 o'clock? She knows her pets will be in the house soon. The dogs love to get at the moles. And she doesn't hear anything back. Oh, and then she says, well, why don't you make sundown? Because she figured they probably didn't know how to tell time. And so she doesn't hear anything, and so she just goes on about her work. And all of a sudden, in about half an hour, she hears a rustle of leaves, and there's at least 100 moles running into the woods. The dogs are so transfixed, they don't know how to do anything. They're just staring. There's lots of stories like that. And another story, I was going to tell you a story from this, I'm forgetting that now. I know the other story. She's created a way for us to understand this as a science, which is gorgeous. And she says, the human kingdom are on an evolutionary spiral. Nature, she says, involution, moving down into matter. And so her model of science with which we can participate is to include in our decision making. She has protocols for holding this for meetings of any number of people. So nature can be part of our decision making. So we would use what she calls conings, C-O-N-E-I-N-G, except there's no E. It's a coning. And we create a coning by calling in two parts of nature and two parts of humanity. And she tells us how and who they are. But basically, it's the David kingdom and Pan for the in nature kingdom. And for us, it's the white brotherhood and our higher self. And then we speak. And there's even more details, but with this we can work with our health. There's a whole book that I didn't grab called MAP, Medical Assistance Program, that's with the white brotherhood and our higher self and Pan and the Deva of Healing. And there's the work is endless. It's awesome. So I call you to it if it calls to you. And you don't have to do anything more than just start talking to Pan and nature as real life. A whole civilization, all embedded with us, that in various ways we've been working with love, respect. However, now we have protocols to do it more and more directly, and so therefore accurately and co-creatively. That's the deal. And we'll each find our way with it, and who knows what will come next, huh? And that's it.